ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन.
Hi everybody, and welcome back. I'm really happy to be here with you again for another session of questions and answers. And I thank so many of you last time for joining the conversation. It was really helpful and exhilarating, actually, to hear from all of you. Thanks to everybody who's online now, who's joined us for the live broadcast. And I already have some of the questions that many of you have been sending in to go through and talk about today. And also, if you're here with us live, you can feel free to write in some of your questions, and we will be looking for them and see if we can answer some of the questions that you send in during this session. We start off with a meditation and a prayer that this broadcast will bring some clarity and peace to us individually, and also that that vibration will spread out to the whole world. Thank you again for joining us. Great to have you. So I have a few questions that have already come in and people anticipating today. And the first one came in from Damodar. And he asked, what should I look for in a partner? And this is a really important question because one of the ways in which human beings are successful in life is by partnering carefully. And our association is actually what determines our future. Those we associate with, we pick up their qualities. So the best advice about partnerships is to find somebody that has integrity. One of the rules of finding a good partner is to make sure that the person is willing to work on him or herself. Because practically, if one thinks that I'm going to change somebody and by my efforts they'll become a better person, then it's usually disappointing. Better to find somebody who's eager to work on him or herself. And if each of the partners works on themselves, then they can meet in the middle and actually help each other. Another trait to look for in a really good partner is common goals. As a partnership, really, whether it's a marriage or long-term friendship, has a lot to do with common goals. And when you're on the same track and you have the same idea what the purpose of your partnership is, then you have something exciting to work on. One of the other rules of thumb is that the idea of love or infatuation isn't always a steady concept. There's infatuation in the beginning, oftentimes, but later on, that wears off very easily. And so having a higher concept of why I'm coming together with somebody and that we're working for something that's meant to improve us, improve the world, is a much better idea for the long term. Is that way, in the partnership, you have something exciting to work on in the long term. So sometimes when people ask me about partnerships, I give them a rather mundane answer. That is, when there's corporate mergers, the two corporations actually study each other and see if it's a good fit. There's a lot to consider on a practical level in relationships besides just whether or not I like someone right now. So get to know the person, share your ideas about common goals, and discuss things ahead of time, especially if you're heading in for a marriage, because these are things that will help you in the long term, deciding ahead of time whether you're compatible or not. There's such a thing as premarital counseling that's been used in a lot of communities around the world where people have a chance to ask each other a lot of questions or have a counselor look and see what some of the commonalities are and when some of the differences are. And actually, it's been proven that the the rate of splitting up is much, much lower for people who take the time ahead of time to look and see if they're compatible in many, many different areas. It's very helpful. So thanks for that question, Damodar. The next question that came in from Bhupendar, he says, my question is it okay to defend myself for the lie to my loved ones? Is it right to tell lies, or should I always tell the truth? In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna recommends that one of the austerities of speech is to always tell the truth. There are cases, however, that are taught in ethics classes at the university level in which you're given a scenario where perhaps, let's say you're hiding somebody who's being sought after by someone with ill intent. And if you tell the truth, that person will definitely be killed. And then the ethical thing to do is, in such cases, it's perhaps permissible to lie in order to protect somebody's life. But in ordinary dealings, telling untruths or even half-truths is very dangerous because it really disturbs the consciousness. And eventually, after some time goes by and the untruth or the lie is discovered, there's always some disturbance. There's disturbance when somebody tells a lie, and there's disturbance later on when people find out that you lied. It hurts in the beginning sometimes to have to tell the truth, but actually in the long run, it develops trust in a relationship. And it's one of the principles actually of yoga to be truthful, because when you tell a lie, then there's repercussions and you sit down to actually introspect, and your mind will be dealing with the repercussions on a subtle level. It's very difficult to be peaceful, to introspect, or even to meditate at all when you lie. So if you take a chance for like a vow for a few weeks or a month or even for a day and see, can I go a whole day without embellishing or telling any lies, and see how hard it is. It's actually one of the principles of yoga, so you can try it out. The next question just came in from Steve on Zoom. Thank you very much, Steve. He said, how do we know we're being a genuine version of ourself? And this is something that is, it's an important question for spiritual advancement. It goes to the principle of integrity. There's an old bit of wisdom about being very true to yourself. And it tells about fasting and how this vow of fasting, someone then, and in some cultures when they fast for a special spiritual purpose, and then they might go underwater during the fast and drink water, because sometimes people fast and they don't even drink water. So this is called drinking water underwater on a fast day. Let's say I've made a vow to fast and then I go to take my bath and underneath I'm drinking water. So if one's cheating in one's vows and in one's and giving up one's integrity, it's very difficult to be true to oneself. This requires a little bit of introspection. The idea of sincerity is, in fact, it comes from a word that means without wax. And in previous ages, when marble became a desirable commodity, some of the people that were selling the marble would take inferior quality marble and then they'd put wax in it, because that would cover up the cracks, which made it inferior marble. Then they would sell it as real marble or high quality marble. And later on, when the heat would melt that wax out, the buyer would find out that actually it wasn't as good as they had thought. And this phrase, sincere, it comes from sinceri, which means without wax. True version of myself means I don't try to cover over all my faults, because otherwise, how will I improve myself if I do that? Don't try to present a version of myself that isn't real. And if I can look daily for that sincerity, it's the most valuable substance. Gives one power, and it goes to integrity also. We just got a question from Hannah. Thank you, Hannah, for writing in. She writes, often as I'm performing my spiritual practice, it can be quite hard to meditate on the service or mantra itself because of my constantly reeling mind, whether it's my pride at work or judgments, etc. Any tips to help counteract this besides patience in the process over time? Yes, well, this is a common problem. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the section on meditation, when Krishna is speaking about the process called dhyana or meditation, his student Arjuna says that it's seemingly impossible to control the mind. It's like controlling the blowing wind. And then the answer that Krishna gives is it's possible by practice and detachment. So one of the ways in which Krishna talks about being able to achieve this detachment is to have some time to see one's higher self. One can actually become aware that one is alive and that I'm the conscious self of my life, this conscious source. And if I can have a vision of that source and see that actually I'm something non-material, it's a vision that is naturally nourishing and helps to give a sense of detachment. It's also important to control one's environment, because whatever we take in through our ears and our eyes, it has repercussions inwardly. For instance, if I'm listening to information that isn't helpful to my meditation, then after some time, I'll find that the vibration is still moving around in my mind. So if you control your environment, you'll find that the mind tends to become more peaceful, especially the sound vibration that we hear. So one of the ways that bhakti yogis practice is when they wake up in the morning, they make sure that the first things that they hear are spiritual sound vibration, like mantra, and they hear a spiritual discourse. That's something you can set up the night before. So when you wake up, you start off on the right foot. And also, one of the tricks for finding time to control the mind is to start earlier in the morning before the sun comes up. The best time to practice, according to all the yoga texts, is about an hour and 45 minutes before the sun comes up, because that's a time in which the passionate modes called rajas are not so much active, and you can find a little bit of peace at that time. And even if you can get a couple of minutes of insight in your practice during those morning hours, it will last all day. So control your environment, make sure you don't have a lot of clutter, and don't take in unnecessary information. Like, there's a lot of news nowadays that tries to agitate your mind, and if you try to control that and listen to spiritual sound vibration, it will help you to control the mind. Thank you very much, Hannah. Here we have one from Facebook, from Joseph. He said, what are the consequences of committing violence to other people? Well, this is actually a revelation that the yoga texts ask us to come to at some point, and that is that whatever we do to others actually comes back to us. Everybody's heard of karma, mostly, that whatever you do comes back to you. But it's a very unrelenting law. And when we commit violence to others, practically speaking, the repercussions will be there in our own consciousness. There's violence that we commit in various ways. In fact, through our speech even, we can commit violence to others. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna recommends that when you speak truthfully, beneficially, and avoid speech that offends. I have a friend who took a vow once during the Kartik month, which is a special month for spiritual practice. It comes around October, November. And he said, for that 1 month, I'll be very careful about how I speak about others. And his vow was not to speak offensive words about others or to others. And right after he made that vow, he started realizing how difficult it was to keep, because it's natural for the tongue to criticize others, to sometimes say things that are a little bit harsh and so forth. But the change in one's life is profound. When you control it in yourself, you try not to be violent towards others, then you'll notice it in your own consciousness that you'll be more self-aware. And by controlling the tongue, especially having a tongue being non-violent, then you'll notice that you'll be filled with a feeling of integrity from being careful about not talking about others in a violent way. So in general, ahimsa or nonviolence is one of the basic principles of a spiritual practice. And you can look into it in body, mind, speech, all the different ways in which we live and we express ourselves. If you can make it nonviolent, then that makes your spiritual practice a lot more viable. Now, Dinesh wrote in just to the website, and he said, how can I find my ideal spiritual guide? I really like this question because it's a very powerful experience in life to have guidance from somebody who's very expert. And there's a story in the Srimad Bhagavatam about a young boy whose name was Dhruva. He was actually a prince. And when he was 5 years old, he was offended by his father, the king. His father had many queens, and he was favoring actually one of the queens. And when Dhruva tried to sit on his father's lap, his father didn't let him because the queen that he favored was there, and she didn't want Dhruva, who wasn't her son, to sit on his father's lap. So his father didn't allow Dhruva to sit there and became very disturbed and angry. So he ran to his biological mother, and with tears in his eyes, he asked, what should I do? And his mother said, well, I've heard that the only help for somebody in this condition is to find God and to take shelter. And he said, how do I do that? And she told him that great yogis go to the forest and they find him there. So he immediately left the palace and started going for the forest, even at 5 years old. And on his way there, he met his spiritual master, Narada Muni. And Narada Muni began questioning him, Dhruva, where are you going? And he gave him some advice that Dhruva didn't want to take, because his advice was to go back to the palace. And when he showed his determination to Dhruva that he was going to the forest, then his teacher, Narada Muni, said, okay, now I'll teach you how to do meditation. So there were two lessons in the story. One was that Dhruva's determination to advance spiritually was so strong that he met his spiritual master by divine order. In other words, the witness, the guide, the super spirit within our heart who is overseeing our activities noticed that he was determined and arranged this meeting with Narada Muni. And the other lesson in the story was that Narada tested him by telling him to go back to his home. And Dhruva wouldn't go. And so it's especially mentioned that the teacher sometimes tests the student to see, is he really serious? So if one wants a good guidance, it comes from one's own very deep desire to know the truth and to advance spiritually. And then there's a way in which by daiva or divine arrangement, one will begin to meet those who can help him or her to advance on the spiritual path, and especially to find one's ideal spiritual teacher. And I'm going through a few of the questions that are here from the website. And if you have any questions that you want to type in, or if you want to also speak up on the Zoom call, feel free to chime in, and we'll take your questions there as well. So the next question comes from Seema, and she says, what's the best way to deal with fanatical people who are often both annoying and aggressive? So many years ago, I read a book called How to Win an Argument. It was written by a professor who talked about how to debate. And in his book, he gave some advice that helped me very much. And it was a section on how to deal with a fanatic. So he said, the first rule in dealing with a fanatic, or someone who's only interested in his or her own opinion and wants to argue for the sake of arguing, is don't. When I read that, I felt greatly relieved, because I'm not obligated. No one's obligated to deal with fanatics in most cases. And so if you find somebody that's utterly fanatic and just wants to argue for the sake of arguing, it's best to get out of the situation as soon as possible. Just politely excuse yourself, because generally those kinds of discussions are not helpful. Argumentative people simply sap our energy and take us away from being able to understand the truth. So feel free, according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, one of the great teachings on bhakti yoga, one should notice the types of people one interacts with and gravitate towards those who are spiritually minded. And one should actually avoid those who are simply fanatical and not interested in reasonably discussing the truth. The next one is, can you give me any practical advice about how to stop procrastinating? I have a lot of good ideas, but I'm wasting my life by procrastinating. This is a common problem that a lot of people have. Procrastination means really that I have the time and I have good ideas, but somehow or other I just can't engage and I put it off to another time. So one of the things to remember is, or to look for, is why I'm doing that, why I'm procrastinating. And one of the reasons that researchers have found that people procrastinate is because they're not exactly sure what the next step is that they have to take. When you think of a project in its entirety, it seems almost impossible and overwhelming to get started, because I might think, from the position I'm in now, how am I actually going to take on such a big project? Now, there's always a next step that's a tiny little step that's really easy. This comes up in the book called Getting Things Done. And the author points out that if you find the tiniest next step and you take that step, then actually you can overcome this sense of being overwhelmed by the project. Because think about it, anything that you do is a series of small steps. So don't think so much in terms of the overall project in its entirety, but think of only what's in the next step. And remember that the point of power is always in the present moment. It's the thing you're doing right now that counts. For instance, when you do algebra is a series of tiny steps. Every one of the steps is actually really simple. It has a rule to it that is not very complex. And if you do one step at a time, then it's not so difficult. But if you just think of it as in its entirety of the whole problem, then it can become overwhelming. So break things down, think in smaller steps, and remember that the point of power is always in the present moment. And also it helps if you have somebody who's a kind of a mentor that you can work with when you're doing projects that can remind you of how to move forward or encourage you to move forward. When I was writing my book, I spent a lot of time procrastinating. And one of the ways I did it was by going to the library and reading books about how to write a book. And almost all of them said, go back and write your book. Finally, two people really helped me, my wife and my editor. And they both cornered me and told me, get in the room and write the book and don't come out until you're done. So it helped to have some oversight, especially for such a big project as writing a book. Here's one from Leela that just came in from the internet. How do we deal with an old father? Let's see, how we deal with old father who thinks everyone is wrong and who wants full power. How do we deal with a father who thinks everyone is wrong and who wants full power? Well, we come into this world with our certain set of relatives, and they're not always completely compatible. One thing in dealing with parents, especially a mother and father, is that it's not so easy sometimes to deal with them. And it requires a little bit of finesse in the relationship. I've found that sometimes people think that they can change their parents by trying to instruct them, and that never works. But it's always best to try to find a compatible situation so that at least you can manage the differences. Instead of trying to change them, try to find ways that you can work with them. And of course, it depends on your physical proximity and your obligation to your parents, how close you are to them and so forth. But this is one of the great challenges. Relatives in general tend to get under our skin sometimes, and finding ways in which to make peace with them is very helpful in having a harmonious life. The next question that just came in is, meditation is a common thread in many different spiritual practices. How do those practices interrelate, and how do they differ? Why do you think it is such a common thread? So in the Bhakti scriptures, it is said, Tato Brahma Jignasa. That means that when you come to the human form of life, it's naturally a time to inquire about what is the ultimate goal of life? Where do I come from? What's the purpose of life? And this is a natural tendency of human beings to want to find out. So one of the obvious ways to investigate is to look inwardly. Meditation is a process that's age old. It's been taught in many different cultures, as the questioner is pointing out here. And it's because human beings have a natural spiritual impetus. And ultimately, finding out who we are and understanding more about the purpose of life requires a little bit of introspection and controlling the mind, which is the ultimate purpose of meditation, to still the mind and actually be able to see myself and to find the super self within. This is what is mentioned in the Yoga Sutra, that Patanjali says the mind, when it's disturbed, is a cause of anxiety, and also we can't see ourselves. We're simply seeing reflected light on a surface that disturbs our awareness. And so these various cultures that present meditation are all looking for the same thing, to control the mind, to find some inner peace. And some have more information than others about what's available when one goes beyond the mind to find what's within. Next question I'm seeing here that just came in from Asaf. He writes, how can I develop enthusiasm? Well, Asaf, thank you for your question about enthusiasm. It's mentioned by one of the great teachers of bhakti named Rupa Goswami that enthusiasm is called utsahan. So he writes in his book called Upadeshamrita, which is the nectar of the teachings about yoga, that utsahan, or enthusiasm, is one of the basic principles of spiritual life and how to advance. One has to have enthusiasm. When you look at the word in English, it actually comes from a root that means entheos, or the God within. So there's a sense that there's more inside us than we necessarily see, and our impetus for moving in life comes from within ourselves. So how to develop more enthusiasm? One of the ways that's recommended is to hear about the goal of life. The more we hear about what the goal is, and the more we understand how to attain it, then the more enthusiastic we become for it, because the more we see the steps, we can understand that actually this is attainable. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was teaching Bhakti Yoga 500 years ago, said that there's three aspects to any endeavor. The first is called sambandha, and that means understanding your relationship with the goal that you're trying to attain. And the second is abhideya, and that means the steps that it takes to get to the goal. And the third is prayojana, and that is the ultimate destination of the goal. And he said it's important to see these three categories in order to have enthusiasm. So relationship, when I understand more about the person I'm trying to develop a relationship with, or if I hear more about the destination that I'm going to, for instance, if someone starts telling me about a place, for instance, an island somewhere, and they say, on this island, you're going to find plentiful fruits, the weather's always perfect, everyone's nice there, they all take care of you, and they go on and on, they start telling me, I'll start thinking, well, how do I get there? And then understanding abhideya, or the steps how to get there, if those are clear, well, here's all you have to do in order to get there. You need to take a flight, and once you get off, you can go, you can get picked up, and they'll take you to the place. I'll understand the steps. And then the ultimate goal, when I get there, you're going to have a place to stay and so forth. These kinds of steps, understanding what the relationship is, what the steps are and how to get there, and what the ultimate goal. Once I have those clearly in mind, then it's natural to be enthusiastic to go towards the goal. And here's Nathan. He just wrote us now and said, how do I overcome the various obstacles on my spiritual path and in life in general, overcoming obstacles? Thank you, Nathan, for such an important question. One of the important ways in which to overcome obstacles is to have a clear idea of my goal in the first place. And if my goal is clear enough, then overcoming obstacles becomes a lot easier because I understand that, first of all, there's always going to be some obstacles, and they're not necessarily bad. They help me to grow. There's always a lesson behind every obstacle. One of the biggest advertising firms in America has a poster on its wall that says, fail harder. And there's an old adage, fail forward fast. Don't be afraid of obstacles, but see them as a way that I get stronger. One of the principles in management is, once you've established your goal, you know what your mission is to list what the obstacles might be or what they are presently, and then brainstorm how to overcome them. It's actually a remarkable process. I've done this many times by myself and with groups of people. And when you actually look at the obstacles carefully, rather than just being annoyed by it or afraid of it, and then you think of ways to overcome it, I always find that there's creative ways to overcome obstacles that I wasn't thinking of before. And so being very clear about what the obstacle actually is, and then thinking of ways to overcome it is very, very helpful. So take some time to think about it and actually define what the obstacle is, and brainstorm ways to overcome each obstacle. And you'll find that this is a process that will help you overcome various obstacles when they come up in your life. Here's a great question from Frank. Thank you, Frank. He says, how can I see good in everyone that I meet? And this is something that is brought up in one of the ancient literatures of the world called the Upanishads. Particularly the Shriya Upanishad, right, gives this verse that when one is able to see beyond just the physical body, and to understand that there's a spiritual entity within each living entity, then such a person never hates anyone. Actually, they appreciate the universality of life. This is, according to the Bhakti scriptures, the perfect vision to have in order to move in the world and to appreciate people. On the physical level, everyone has differences. But the most highly advanced people spiritually, as is said in the Bhagavad Gita, see beyond just the superficial material body, and they see that we all have a common spiritual nature. So the verse in the Bhagavad Gita, which Krishna speaks, is Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmanigavi Hastini Shuni Chaiva Shupake Cha Pandita Samadarshina. And this says that a person who is advanced in spiritual vision sees a dog, an elephant, a man, a rich man, a poor man, all equally, because that advanced person notices that the body's only a superficial covering that the living entities have taken on because of their past activities and karma, but inside they're all the same. Therefore, he has a similar respect for all of them. It's not that he treats them all equally. In other words, if such a person, like a sage, sees a tiger, it's not that just because he sees the spiritual nature, he'll go pet the tiger, because he knows that that tiger may attack him. Nonetheless, he has the spiritual acumen to understand that the tiger is actually a spiritual entity within, and therefore he respects equally that tiger and a man on the spiritual level. There are practicalities, though, in dealing with each one of them. But this is the common principle for actually appreciating every living being. And just today I was working in the garden, and when I walked away from cutting some flowers, I noticed that there was an inchworm on my hand. I felt him, and then I looked down and I saw this little worm. And I was just marveling at him for a few minutes. And I was seeing that actually it's an amazing creature. And within him is the same spiritual spark that's within me and within, the cats or the dogs or any other kind of living entity. There's a spiritual, common spiritual spark within that's amazing. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the spiritual spark is the most amazing principle in the universe. When you notice it, the consciousness within the living entity, some people, he says, see it as amazing. Some hear of it as amazing. Some, even after analyzing it and hearing about it, can't understand it at all. But if we take time to notice that and we develop the vision that actually ultimately behind the material covering, the spiritual soul is the amazing principle that's animating these physical bodies, then we'll actually have respect for other living beings and we'll marvel at life in general within this universe. And let's see, there have been a lot of questions coming in while I'm talking here, so I'll just have to see what I can pick out. Are there ways, here's one from Anantadev, he says, are there ways of not getting burnt out in a demanding career? And the answer to that comes in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, yukta hara viharasya yukta cheshtasya karmasu yukta swapna babodasya yogo bhavati dukaha. Krishna recommends that we don't overwork, and also that we don't underwork. In fact, what he says in the verse I just quoted is that one who doesn't eat too much or eat too little, sleep too much or sleep too little, recreate too much or recreate too little. In other words, live a balanced life and use the balance of your time when you're not working to maintain yourself for spiritual advancement. This is the most important principle, to have a daily spiritual practice and to not live in excess. And also, don't deprive yourself. You have to live in a balanced way. And if you do that, even amidst a demanding career, especially have a basic spiritual practice every day, which might include mantra meditation and reading something from the wisdom literatures. This is one of the most recommended of all the processes. If you hear the best ideas that are available, they go into your ear, into your mind, and they give you fortification when you're dealing with your work in the world so that you don't become overwhelmed by it. It gives you some perspective. It's really important. So have a basic spiritual practice. And also in your bodily activities, make sure that you're a little bit balanced. Don't overeat. Don't undereat also, and all the different aspects of your life. And then Krishna says, yogo bhavati dukaha. Dukaha means that you'll become free from distress by living in a balanced way. So we've taken a little time to come together here to discuss some questions and some answers. And I just saw that, okay, someone just wrote in. Here it is, from Saheli. Okay, a question just came in from Facebook. How can I look for like-minded association while keeping my propensity for fault-finding in check? Conversely, how can I keep my vision of others in a Vasudeva Kutumbakam frame without opening myself to dangerous association? How do we keep both views of the tiger or inchworm or whomever in functional balance? Wow, such great questions. There's a lot here, and actually I think we're running out of time. So let me just answer part of those, and I'll answer the rest of a part of this, and I'll talk about the rest of it later. How can I look for like-minded association while keeping my propensity for fault-finding in check? Well, first of all, you know, keeping fault finding in check is a full-time occupation, and it's worthwhile. If you make it a priority to keep fault finding in check, as the great saint Srila Bhaktisiddhanta used to say, make it a full-time occupation to find your own faults. Don't look for them in others. You'll find plenty of within yourself. Also, don't become overwhelmed by all your faults, but try to see the ways in which you can improve yourself. And just see if you can keep quiet about other people's faults. There's no edict that says you have to bring up all the faults in other people. It's not required. But it is helpful if you look for your own and find ways to overcome them. That could become an interesting project. And looking for like-minded association, really, if you have clear goals about things you want to accomplish in your life, it's very likely that you'll find like-minded association, because people will notice what you're doing and then they will gravitate towards you. For instance, in spiritual practice, those who, for instance, are very much into japa, mantra meditation, and they take time to do it, will find that they'll resonate with other people who are doing that. And those who when you find somebody that resonates with what you're doing, make an alliance. That's one of the most helpful things that you can do for your spiritual practice, is find such people who have similar kinds of enthusiasm and then agree to meet at some kind of interval. This is actually the essence of the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for advancing in spiritual life. Form a group, even if it's small, even if it's one other person or a couple other people, and then pursue your goals together, and you'll find that you advance very quickly in spiritual life. I'll definitely answer the rest of those that you put up there later, because they're really great. Ramakrishna wrote in, how to balance spiritual life, work, and family life. Could you please explain? But if I'm not incorrect, I think I've come to the end of my time. JP, the time is up, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we are 3 minutes behind our time, final time.
Okay, 3 minutes over. Well, if there's anybody else that wanted to check in, do so, because we'll collect all your questions and we'll be going. We'll be saving them all and bringing them out at one time or another in sessions that are coming up soon. And thank you very much, everyone, for taking time to check in today for this session. Thanks for all of you who wrote in such nice questions to the website at vaisheshikadas.com. And we'll look forward to seeing you in the next session. And for now, we're signing off, and keep the transcendental vibration going. That's the main secret in life, is the sound vibration you hear will develop your consciousness, and your consciousness will develop your life. Thank you very much for joining. And I'll look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you very much. Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman. Hey, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman.